93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
Is it true that you broke up Fish?
sort of. I don't know. I went to go review a couple of Fish shows that were in Las Vegas in 2004, and the shows were really bad. And I wrote these reviews, and they weren't. I didn't think I was being terribly mean. I kind of just said I wish they practiced more. And I saw Mike Gordon, the band's bassist, and he was like, "Yeah." Trey read that review, and then that's what sort of opened the meeting where we ended up, where we broke up. But there were also, you know, there's some other stuff that was going on.
Hey, don't pass off responsibility, Jesse. It was 100% your fault. So
it's all my fault.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. My guests today are Jesse Jarnow, the author of Heads, a great book about sort of the history of psychedelic America and the Grateful Dead, and sort of the history of the jam band scene in a lot of ways in the United States. And I'm talking with Todd Snyder, one of my favorite singer-songwriters. He's also now the lead singer of a band called Hardworking Americans, sort of a side project of Widespread Panic. So, yeah, this is a special jam band episode of Celebration Rock, which I know will excite some people and it will put some people off, but I'm hoping to unite both the tribes on this episode. But before we get to that, I want to tell you about our sponsor for today's episode, and that is our old friends at Blue Apron. Now, Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and they do this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the higher standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. I've been using Blue Apron for the past month, and the meals have been delicious, and I've been cooking for my family, and they make it really easy. The meals are great. Like, the meals that they're going to be offering this month in August include spiced pork burgers, a summer vegetable and quinoa bowl, chicken tinga tacos, and there's lots of other great stuff, too. Now, the way that you get into Blue Apron is you go to the website, and that website is blueapron.com. And as a special incentive to try out Blue Apron, you want to go to blueapron.com/celebration. And if you do that, you're going to get your first three meals for free. And you're also going to be supporting this podcast. So again, go to blueapron.com/celebration and get three meals free from Blue Apron. Okay, so again, this is our special jam band episode. And I was inspired to do this because I've become much more interested in this scene over the past couple years. I've become a pretty big fan of the band Fish. I saw three shows this summer after seeing a couple shows of the past couple years. And it's fascinating to me because I feel like people don't really know anything about this scene, and yet they have a sort of a knee-jerk dislike of it. And to me, I guess what has drawn me to it, aside from just enjoying a lot of the bands, is sort of the culture of it. It does seem like one of the few genuine subcultures that exist in music today. That, you know, there's a lot of jam band stuff that exists online, but you don't really hear it ever discussed in mainstream media. You don't ever see it sort of accessed by people who aren't inside of it. So it's this thing that is sort of out in the open, and yet people don't know anything about. And I just thought that would be a great thing to explore on this episode. So, first of all, I called up Jesse Jarnow, who, again, wrote this great book called Heads, which is a great primer for you if you're interested in this scene. We're going to start with Jesse talking about his book, as well as Fish and Dead and Company, and Dead and Company, of course, being the recent side project with John Mayer, and a lot of other jam bandy things. So here's our conversation. Well, Jesse, it's great to have you on the podcast. I just want to begin by telling you that I read your recent book, Heads. I was going to say new book. It's fairly new. It came out in March, and I really, really liked it. And, of course, it's a book, you know, it's about the psychedelic history of America, I guess, and you use the Grateful Dead as the spine of the story, and you go off in all these different directions. It's a very panoramic story. And as I was reading the book, it made me think, you know, like, are you familiar with that new show Roadies on Showtime, that Cameron Crowe show?
Familiar. I haven't seen it yet, but you know, I know about it.
Okay, so that show's unfortunate for many reasons, but one of the reasons why I think it's unfortunate is that as I was reading your book, and I had this thought too as I read Dennis McNally's book about the Grateful Dead, is that there's a great TV show to be made about not exactly the Grateful Dead, but the world around the Grateful Dead. You know, the roadies, the crew, the people in the parking lot. As I was reading your book, it made me think of like The Wire in a way, like just how deep it was and how there is crime, you know, that was going on in there. But it's also just about the hierarchies that go on and how there's really, it's like its own world and there's like a set of codes and you kind of, you get immersed in this world like you do on shows like The Wire or The Sopranos. And I just think it's a fascinating thing. And now I feel like because of this roadie shows exists, maybe it can't happen. But I mean, I imagine that that must have been the attraction for you. I mean, obviously you're a Grateful Dead fan, but this book is really about so much more than that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess my initial spark for wanting to write the book, and it was sort of in a different form than what it became, was that I wanted to write a book about the Grateful Dead's impact on American culture. And I kind of sort of kept pulling that view back until sort of just getting to the realization that it was sort of that the psychedelic world and the Grateful Dead world were inseparable, and together they created this kind of big universe that I kind of found myself in as, you know, sort of as, you know, a high school, a fledgling, you know, a young deadhead in high school, kind of, you know, first learning about this stuff, that there was this whole, like, kind of alternate reality out there that sort of, like you were saying, follows its own codes and sort of has its own kind of, this, you know, this sort of set of spiritual beliefs kind of built around psychedelics. And I wanted to, like, understand that. And that was, you know, that was sort of one big way into that. And man, yeah, no, I think a TV show built around the dead, or built around the dead's roadies would be fantastic. I think there's one in the works, sort of, for, involving Steve Parrish, Jerry Garcia's roadie, wrote a memoir, and I think they're turning that into a show. I have a fantasy about a Grateful Dead show about the roadies, where you never see the band. It's just the roadies, and it's sort of like the band members are just sort of this off-camera voice.
Right, and that's one thing that the roadies, that Cameron Cho, does right. Like, there's a fictional band at the center of it, and you don't really see them. It's more about everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, yeah, when I was reading your book, it did make me think of, like, on The Sopranos, about how you had the bosses, and then you had the captains, and then you had the guys working beneath the captains, and, like, you know, and, like, how do you kick the money up, and how do you do this? And, like, in the Grateful Dead world, I mean, you talk about you know, the parking lot scene and like how they're, you know, and obviously the distribution of psychedelics that was going on, and how the Grateful Dead and how their tours were a hub for LSD distribution, you know, in the 70s and 80s. But I mean, just the codes that would go on, you know, just the operation around that band, I think is really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there were all these kind of different currencies existing. You know, LSD was one of them, you know, this sort of this big, you know, sort of commodity that existed around the Dead. And obviously that flowed back and forth with money, you know, and, you know, there is a hierarchy of, you know, who, you know, how does this stuff get around, where, you know, where does the money go, that kind of thing. But there's also all kinds of other currency involved in the Dead world. Where you have things, you know, I guess as simple as like concert tickets. There's also the world of live Dead tapes. There's, you know, all kinds of, you know, other drugs and things being exchanged in Grateful Dead parking lots. So it really kind of became, LSD kind of became sort of the gravitational center for kind of this whole economy that goes, you know, if you're a police officer looking at it, you call it a black market. But there's just so many more aspirations for it because there are psychedelics involved, and these people who have, you know, they want to, people who are selling acid generally want to save the world. It's not, you know, certainly there's probably money involved, but that was definitely one thing that sort of came up again and again in research, is that the people who are working at sort of the upper parts of the LSD world, either manufacturing it or distributing it or whatever, are not equivalent to the people in, like, you know, say, like, the cocaine world or something like that. It's not, you know, maybe there are being guns carried around, but there's still, like, this sort of peaceful warrior mode or something like that that I think exists at that level. And that, you know, it's at every level of the dead world, and it makes it this, like, thing that's, it's sort of unlike, you know, I don't want to say anything else, but it's unlike pretty much anything else.
Yeah, and, you know, in the way you write the book, too, I think is really evocative of that, of this sort of free-flowing world that you're describing. I mean, at times when I was reading your book, I felt like I was on acid or that I was in the middle of a trip. And I feel like that's, to some degree, intentional. I mean, there's a very, you know, it rolls very well. It's a very, you know, you make very kind of good segues into things, you know, in and out of things. The other thing I thought was fascinating about the book, you know, and we're talking about sort of the insular world of the Grateful Dead, is that you also do a really good job of talking about how that world has influenced the outside world, particularly in terms of the internet and how, I guess, would you say like the free economy in a way, that it's not an economy based on money, that there's now so much, you know, that sort of internet ethos that information longs to be free and that you're sort of trading things going beyond money. I mean, is that like a fair summation of what you're getting at in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. Though, you know, that information wants to be free philosophy, the idea of, you know, sort of free software, free information, free whatever, has just these really intimate, deep ties to the dead world through groups like the Diggers, who are sort of the, you know, sort of anarchist philosophers of the Haight-Ashbury era. And just sort of the intuitive free thing that was going on with people trading tapes, where the deadheads very early on in kind of the history of tape trading decided that it was going to be free. You can't charge for tapes. You can't make money on it. It has to just be an exchange of the music. And that eventually took just really deep root in the dead world because, you know, it was sort of a piece with the earlier stuff from the Haight era. But then you get in kind of to the digital world, and it very much is a continuation of that. You know, the first free software company in Silicon Valley in the 80s were all deadheads. There was one of the guys behind it was this guy Gumby, who was like an early, you know, deadhead Usenet freak, who was like hanging out at the Stanford lab and went on to start this company. And it goes up into the era, it goes up to now, but, you know, you look at like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which was co-founded by John Perry Barlow, who was Bob Weir's lyricist in the dead. And also, I guess, Brent Midland's lyricist on a couple of things. But it gets really complicated trying to draw that all the way to the present moment, because there is obviously free is still kind of, you know, the currency of the internet, but it becomes so much more complicated in kind of like, you know, the freemium Spotify age, where you're sort of exchanging personal information in exchange for getting something, quote-unquote, for free, which was actually a point that the Diggers made in the 60s about surrendering, you know, sort of autonomy and personal information and things like that in return for things that appeared to be free, but that maybe, you know, maybe there are, you know, unspoken terms and conditions, that kind of thing. But I think it's a really, considering the whole arc of free and the Grateful Dead and technology, I think is a really, I found it a really valuable way to sort of investigate and kind of like poke at what free actually means in now in the sort of the tech age.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of shades in there.
Well, and I think that's a fascinating thing to explore, because I feel like when people think about the Grateful Dead and the jam band scene in general, they think of it essentially as sort of a nostalgic form of music, that it's all about looking back. It's all about reliving the 60s. And yet, in this book, and also you wrote a story for Wired last year around the time of the Well concerts that I thought was really interesting, where you talked about how the Grateful Dead and Deadheads have been at the forefront of technology in a lot of ways in terms of music, whether it is, you know, fans assembling in Usenet groups online, you know, in the early 90s, you know, being among the first fan bases online, or just, you know, the Grateful Dead, how they pioneered, you know, audio technology, you know, the way that we hear concerts live. The Dead were often at the sort of the forefront of that. Could you talk about that? I mean, that seems like something I feel like is underrated with that band, because, again, they do get kind of pigeonholed as this sort of 60s thing, whereas maybe, in a lot of ways they're futurists in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my favorite, like, recent example, huge recent example, or semi-recent at this point, is that, you know, sort of deadheads and fishheads were the people responsible for getting kind of the critical user mass of BitTorrent when BitTorrent first launched. It's, you know, a direct evolution out of the tape trading scene where that was sort of the initial killer usage for it before movies and all that kind of thing. There are a lot of aspects to that. I mean, part of that is that, you know, the devs do get pigeonholed as a 60s band, but they were a huge 80s band. You know, that was when right. their only real hit was the 80s. And really what that means is that there's a continuity of deadheads. They never stopped breeding new deadheads. Their deadheads is like every generation. I went to that to see the Dead & Co show at Fenway Park in Boston a couple weekends ago, and it was amazing, like, really how, you know, legitimately all ages these show, you know, the sort of the Dead scene is. And it's actually true. If you just go to see a random Grateful Dead cover band, you'll get this age spread of, you know, people in their 70s and teenagers who are just sort of discovering like the Dead and Acid for the first time and all that. And I think that powers the technology end of it a lot, is that there is this sort of unending back end to the Grateful Dead world, wanting to have this music and wanting to be able to access this world and find the others and find where the Dead community is. And that pushes people to the newest ways to do that. And that's always been true. Just this being a Deadhead is sort of about this kind of blinding passion for Grateful Dead music. It's you know, you want, you know, a lot of Deadheads want every tape and want to be able to go to every show. And so that means, you know, using the latest and greatest technology to be able to do that. And that is completely true of Fish. It's completely true probably of a lot of obsessive fan bases. But I think that, you know, sort of Deadheads and Fishheads pretty obviously, you know, are the forerunners to, you know, the Beliebers or the Beehive or whatever obsessive fan groups are, you know, current. Like, Deadheads were, you know, organizing ridiculous fan-oriented activities on the internet long before any of them, and continue to. It's just, yeah, it's still there.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I mean, I think that is the biggest misconception that outsiders have of certainly Deadheads and Fish fans and, like, just jam band fans in general. Like, I know for me, like, I'm a relatively recent convert. Like, in the last 3 or 4 years, I've become a Fish fan, and like I've been going to shows. I went to 3 shows this summer, which for Fish fans is not a lot, but for, you know, for me, it was the most I ever went to in one summer, and I really love it. You know, I have the apps. There's like the official Fish app, and then there's the Fish OD app. So I've been listening to the shows through that, and part of the appeal for me has been sort of the obsessiveness of the fans. The fact that there's so much mythology to explore in these bands makes it very exciting. You know, you always feel like there's still more to discover, even if you've listened to so many things. Even if you've only listened to the albums, there's like hundreds of or thousands of shows that have been recorded. And if you listen to the shows, you find that people have obsessively sort of documented every aspect of the show. Like, there's even like people measuring the gaps between songs and like things like that, or like when the last time a song was played. I mean, when I try to explain this to people, you know, I liken it to, you know, baseball nerds who are really into, you know, into statistics. I mean, it is like that, or sabermetrics or whatever, which runs contrary to sort of the stoned hippie stereotype, you know, that there's just sort of people out there that'll take anything that they hear. It doesn't matter because they're all smashed on drugs anyway. When in fact, in the communities that I've seen, these are some of the most critical, sometimes to the point of insanity, fan bases I've ever been around. You know, very persnickety, very, very critical, but kind of fascinating to be around. You know, I'm wondering for you, you mentioned how you were a Deadhead, you know, as a teenager, and I think we're around the same age. Like, how old are you?
I'm old enough where I have to do the math. 37.
Okay, so I'm 38. I'm going to be 39 in a couple months. So, like, we both grew up in the 90s.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you mentioned the Dead being an 80s band. You know, they were still, you know, gathering new fans in the 90s, even after Jerry Garcia died, of course.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, what was it about that for you that drew you in? Because it's not the obvious thing to be into. Like, why What sucked you into that world?
Well, I mean, for me personally, it was the older tapes. That was what made me a Deadhead, was discovering that real sweet spot, that sort of that music nerd sweet spot from you know, their founding in 1965 to kind of like my deep interest, I'll say, kind of probably starts to tail off towards the late 70s. But, you know, like you were saying, there's just so much mythology. I've been listening to Grateful Dead music pretty obsessively for 20 years now, and there's still just so much more to discover for me. And that's a huge part of it. But I think for a lot of people, and I wasn't like going out and follow, you know, when I identified as a teenage Deadhead, it wasn't like I was going around and following Rat Dog around or anything like that. You know, I would see them, I think I've saw Rat Dog maybe like three times in my life or something like that. But I think for a lot of people, that is the appeal. If there is something going on in real time, it's not just this historical phenomenon, but it's like a real place you can go where there's, you know, people intersecting with one another from all these different worlds. You know, the Dead scene in the 70s and the 80s and still now is this like giant tent for all different kinds all different kinds of white people, basically. But you know, I know Fishheads and Deadheads who are, you know, all the way to the, you know, the left in every way in terms of, you know, the political spectrum, in terms of the music and culture they're into. But I also know, I wouldn't say just as many, but, you know, there are people who are way into this stuff who are extremely conservative in, you know, culturally speaking and otherwise. And that's a real appeal to it, to go to this place where all that stuff is going on. And I think that the sports comparison that you brought up before is extremely valid. And actually goes really, really deep, I think, and beyond the stats, but just it's this thing to interact with and this thing to do. And one of my favorite kind of like little innovations, or big innovations, I guess, over the past 3 or 4 years in sort of the jam world and the Dead world, is what people call couch tour.
Right.
And I don't ever really stream a show and watch it like on my couch. Just as comparison, I'm a huge baseball fan. I'm a Mets fan, and I, like, there's just something to me about like flipping on the baseball game and being maybe somewhat invested in it. You know, invested in the bigger picture of it, but sort of having it on and being present with it. And there's that aspect to the Fish thing and to the Dead thing that's really happened in the last few years, where it's like, oh, it's 9 p.m. Fish are playing somewhere, and I can go online and, you know, people are streaming the show. You know, someone's, you know, maybe they've got their phone on a selfie stick and they're streaming it through Mixlr or something like that. And that there's that sort of kind of casual but very engaged way to do it. And I think that's a huge appeal to sort of the present tense notion of going to see Phil and Friends, or going to see the Dark Store Orchestra, or going to see, you know, Dead & Company, which is, you don't have to be totally analytical, and probably the vast amounts of people who are going to these shows are just going because they want to. It's really fun to be in a room with everybody, you know, with 10, you know, however many thousands of people who all know the same songs and all get really psyched when the band starts playing Terrapin Station or whatever. And that's really powerful, like, to like all kind of like share that little charge.
Yeah.
And I think that's, oh, and you know, the math and the geek stuff kind of follows, but.
Yeah. I mean, well, like, you know, what you were saying about the couch tour aspect, for me too, it's been also having these apps, like the fact that you can have such a, I mean, like you said, there's people that often will sort of clandestinely like live stream the show as it's happening, but if you just want to get like a great recording of it, you can get, if you get the app, you have it within like, you know, an hour or two of the show ending, and you can listen to the whole show, and you can follow it like a baseball team or a football team or whatever, where you're like, oh, okay, so this show was like pretty good, but like it wasn't, like, the second set wasn't as good as the second set from last week that I heard. And it is sort of like, you know, when they're on tour, you listen to those shows like for the month or so that the tour is happening, and it is like that, and it's been a lot of fun. You know, you mentioned earlier how you saw Dead & Company at Fenway Park, and you wrote about it for Pitchfork, and I want to get to that later. But before we get, because, you know, I thought that was a great story, and it was also a surprise. Your take on it somewhat surprised me.
Interesting.
But, you know, the story this year with the Grateful Dead has been how they're, there's another period right now of sort of revisionism with the Grateful Dead, or like it seems like every 10 to 15 years, the indie rock world decides that the Grateful Dead are good after all, and they put out like a tribute record, you know, and that's supposed to make it acceptable to like the Grateful Dead. And this year it was Day of the Dead, which was the, you know, the multi-disc tribute album put together by the National, which, by the way, if you want to go back a little bit farther to 91, I think it was, there was a tribute album called Dedicated.
Right,
which was supposed to sort of rehabilitate the Grateful Dead in sort of the alt-rock world. You know, Jane's Addiction was on that record, and I can't remember the other ones. Like, the Jane's Addiction cover is the famous cover for
the Ripple.
The Ripple one, which is sort of like a weird psychedelic reimagining of that song. But
there's
anyway...
Go ahead. I was also going to shout out one that doesn't get mentioned as much as Dedicated, which is Stolen Roses, which is from, I think, 96 or 97 or something, which has, like, you know, there's more Elvis Costello on there, Patti Smith is on that, Bob Dylan is on that. There's some nice deep cuts there.
Okay, so that's another one to dig out.
Not quite as... That one actually, at least to me, is not quite as dated as Dedicated. Kind of, kind of a lot because, like, who's on there. I mean, there's some pretty... Don't get me wrong, there's some pretty... dated, jammy, bandy things on there. I think there's like a, there might be this Fire Up the God. Yeah, I don't know. There's some Fire on the Mountain, like alternate lyric thing going on. Anyway.
Okay.
Sorry.
But anyway, it seems more or less established that the Grateful Dead are sort of an acceptable band to like if you were in the indie world now. But then you have a band like Phish, and I know that you were also, you know, huge into Phish, and you wrote a lot about Phish in the 90s and 2000s, and I'm not sure where you're at with them now, but they're a band that still doesn't get a lot of respect necessarily. They're a band that I've really come to love. And what the in was for me was that when I listened to Phish, I noticed that the similarity to the Grateful Dead was that the Dead, what they do is they sort of synthesize all the forms of like 20th century music, like before 1960. So you have blues, jazz, folk, country, and early rock and roll, like all in the Grateful Dead. Whereas with Phish, what they do is they synthesize the history of classic rock from like the late 60s to the early 80s. So like roughly say from, I guess if you want to say the Dead or like sort of the blues rock stuff of the late 60s to like the Talking Heads in the early 80s. And in the middle there you have funk and you have punk and all the stuff that kind of existed in between there. That was sort of the in for me. For them, like how they sort of comment on classic rock history, how they subvert it and honor it, and I feel like they kind of carry that spirit forward in a way that I think is more interesting than any other band that's, you know, kind of come down the pike in the last couple decades. I mean, does that resonate for you at all?
Yeah, it does, and I think I think a couple of reasons why, you know, so I did actually just write an article about Phish for the Pitchfork Review, so it's possible they are getting cool again, into me being assigned to do that. But at the same time, there are pieces about what they do that I feel like would have a hard time resonating with a lot of sort of, I guess, the indie aesthetic. And some of that is actually the hidden piece of Phish influence that I think is actually pre-60s, which is that they're actually really influenced by, like, show tunes and kind of that era of pop music. So there's kind of this, like, very populist, kind of corny aspect to Phish, where there's sort of the barbershop and kind of these big gestures that they, which, you know, is sort of the stadium rock thing as well. But there is this really earlier model of pop that's very much part of their music as well, where there's a complexity to their music. I know Trey Anastasio has talked about being really influenced by big bands and kind of like the idea of a big band where every musician in the band is like, you know, the best at his craft, and the arranger is the best at his craft, and you've got, like, you know, this very artful thing, which in a lot of ways is really different from what the Dead were doing. And in that sense, Phish don't write songs that you can, like, really sing around campfires, or, you know, maybe there are a few, but there's nothing like, you know, really like American Beauty and Working Man's Dead, and just those, like, those songs that are universal and can just be, you know, strummed anywhere.
Well, it's the rock aspect too of what they do. You know, like a lot of indie music, it derives from punk, which is, you know, in the narrative of rock music, punk was supposed to be a rejection of like Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Yes and all those bands, whereas Phish totally integrates like that right. part of 70s rock, and they do it in a way that is faithful but also irreverent at the same time.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, the aspect of their music that I really love is that sort of adventurousness and that sort of like, come with us on a journey,
Totally.
That's what I love about prog rock too. This idea of like, you know, we're gonna go deep through this through the mists of this mystical land,
and
it's kind of fanciful, but it's also, it can be really fun if you just give yourself over to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge difference between sort of the prog and the punk thing, where punk kind of, you know, the classic message of punk is, you know, three quarters in the truth or whatever, you know, anybody can do this. Whereas with Phish, there's so much of it that's like the guitar god element and just sort of the prog element of these guys are really good at this and, you know, play really complicated stuff pretty fast and, you know, I can't do that. So I'm paying money to go see these people who are incredible at that. And the thing that appeals to me about Phish, like even now, and, you know, I'll go see them. I casually engage with Phish. I'll go see them if I don't have to spend the night somewhere, if I can sleep in my own bed afterwards, is the weirdness. Is that when they get to that point where they're all four of them are improvising at the same time and, you know, really listening to one another, there is that, like, singular voice that comes out that is unlike any other band. And that happens for them compositionally as well, where they have, you know, these long, intricate songs, you know, mostly by Trey, where it's just so, those songs are so bizarre. Like, all the, like, and it's not just, oh, we're playing in weird time signatures or something like that. It's the playfulness of the way those things are sort of built on top of one another and the way these, like, ridiculous rhythms kind of become, like, singable almost or something. Like, I can, like, clap along to like these weird little, you know, middle sections and like, you know, the divide in Divided Sky or You Enjoy Myself or, you know, that are, I have no idea what time signature they're in, but they're just so catchy somehow that they're engaging and I can remember them.
Well, and the playful aspect of it, I think, is what maybe neophytes don't get as much. The fact that, like, you know, like, on one hand, people take Phish shows extremely seriously, but there's also an element of like, well, if we screw up, it's not that big of a deal because there's another show. You know, like, we're going to kind of lay it out there. Kind of, you know, I guess, again, to go back to the baseball analogy, that like, okay, we're going to try to win today, but if we don't, it's okay because we have another game tomorrow and we're still going to play balls out and do what we can do. You know, I have to ask before we get to the Dead & Co. thing, is it true that you broke up Phish?
It depends how you define all those terms, but sort of. I don't know.
Because you used to write about them a lot for Relics magazine.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So the story, as I've come to understand it, is this: I went to go review a couple of Phish shows that were in Las Vegas in 2004, and I was writing a bit, and I convinced Relics to send me there. I was also writing a big feature article about sort of the emergence of politics in the jam band scene, because that's a really complicated topic of, you know, jam bands are kind of apolitical or whatever, and it made sense at the time to go to Vegas and do this thing. And I kind of, you know, I wanted to see the shows. It seemed like a fun thing to go do. And the shows were really bad. They were just real bad. They weren't playing any new songs. They were kind of playing just only old songs, and they were clearly not rehearsed, or they just weren't playing them well. There was something really just, like, off about the whole thing, and I wrote about that, and I didn't really want to speculate about what that offness was, other than that it was manifesting in the music, and that was kind of a bummer and unfair to, you know, pretty much everybody in that show had come in from someplace to see this performance, and the fact that they were up there and, you know, playing kind of badly was I don't know, was kind of offensive in some ways to me. And I wrote these reviews, and they weren't, I didn't think I was being terribly mean in them, or you know, maybe stern and a little upset, but I kind of just said I wish they practiced more and and whatever. And about a month or so later, they announced that they're breaking up. And this comes in the form of a letter from Trey that he posted on the Phish website. And in that letter, there were a couple of things that basically directly paraphrased like what I wrote. And that was really weird. And I definitely wasn't the only one who noticed that. And I started getting a lot of like pissed off email, I guess, which didn't stop for a while. Eventually I saw Mike Gordon, the band's bassist, and he was like, yeah, Trey read that review, and then that's what sort of opened the meeting where we broke up. So that's sort of the arc of how it happened in real time, but there were also, I can't remember how many, is it 2 years after that, 3 years after that, Trey gets busted and ends up in, a rehab program. There's some other stuff that was going on.
Hey, don't pass off responsibility, Jesse. It was 100% your fault. So,
it's all my fault. I wake up in the middle of every night sobbing, thinking about it.
Yeah. We got you on the record now admitting it. It's 100% Jesse's fault. So he's nailed to the
wall.
Totally,
I did it. What's that Bill Hicks line? Yep, that was me. I did it. Pulled up G12, Tommy.
Well, before I let you go, I want to bring up something else you wrote, and which was that recent you saw Dead & Co, which is the sort of the newest, newfangled version of the Grateful Dead. You have Bob Weir, you have Bill Kreutzmann, you have Mickey Hart, and then you have some other people. I guess it's the core three now. We're down to the core three.
Yeah, I mean, not my core three, man.
But then you also have the wild card, which is John Mayer playing in the Dead, which no one would have predicted probably a couple years ago, but here we are. And I know when I was going into your story, I thought, okay, well, Jesse, he's a student of the Dead, he's a big fan. I was expecting a turkey shoot, basically, that you were just going to nail John Mayer to the wall. And, and there's a couple, good lines at his expense, but for the most part, you come away with a fairly positive take on it, at least, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like what you were saying is that, given the circumstances, that he kind of does the best job that you could hope for in 2016.
Yeah, as long as he doesn't sing, I think is sort of my takeaway.
Or you can't see him. Like, I find when I've listened to their recordings that they sound pretty good, but when I've watched the videos of it, it's very jarring to see John Mayer's guitar faces.
Right. Well, that's a different. There are giant screens at the stadium, but another aspect of you're actually there at a baseball stadium seeing these guys. Yeah, he's being blown up to a giant size, but there's also a lot of other stuff I can focus on. I try not to watch screens when I'm at shows and try to actually focus on those tiny little people off in the distance. So that made it easier. But for me, it was they channeled the vibe. A friend of mine has the phrase Disney dead to describe what they do, which is pretty true. There's sort of a reductionist aspect to it. But the fact that I just enjoyed, being in the stadium with all those people who were really enjoying that music, and there was something powerful about them creating that.
Yeah.
The Dead haven't, the Dead have been kind of cheesy for a long time, so I think I'm probably sort of no better than to expect them to come out and, open up with a crazy, 30-minute, the 11 that goes backwards into St. Stephen or something like that. my expectations are, I feel like, pretty realistic at this point for what's going to happen. And in that sense, I was really surprised. I did expect kind of going into like turkey shoot John Mayer, but he was, his guitar playing. I saw them in November at the Garden, and I thought, I really hated that show. If I had written a review of that show, that would have been probably what maybe you were expecting out of this one. But I felt like he actually, since that show, has really kind of opened up and like seems to have more of a vocabulary at his command than he did in the fall. In terms of, you know, he's a blues rock guitar player who's sort of working to get out of his box as a blues rock guitar player, and he's clearly got chops, but maybe doesn't fully, you know, he's, you know, I think he'd probably admit that as well, that he's, well, you know, he's trying to escape that.
Well, yeah, and it's a very savvy move on John Mayer's part, because I don't know how closely you've followed John Mayer's career. I'm guessing not very.
Not at all.
But, you know, he put out a record in 2013 called Lonesome Valley, which he recorded in Montana, like he had just moved to Montana. And on the cover, he's wearing, like, a poncho and, like, three vests and a cowboy hat, and there's, like, a dog next to him.
Oh, I've seen that picture,
and,
right, yes.
And I think that marks the beginning of him moving in this jam band direction, and because there's some sort of Jerry-sounding guitar licks on that record. And in interviews at that time, I think he was also talking about getting into the Grateful Dead and being really inspired
right.
by them. And I think there's a recognition on some level with him that, like, the sort of pop rock stuff that he was doing in the early 2000s that made him really successful, like, that music doesn't even exist anymore on the radio. Like, it's been totally blown out of the block. So for him to have a career, it's going to be as a guitarist. And as now, I think when he, you know, I don't know how long he's going to be with the Dead here, but, you know, he's now going to have the residual effects of this for the rest of his career. I mean, Bruce.
Oh, yeah, the curse. That's what they call it.
Well, but it's also going to, you know, he's going to get Deadhead showing up at.
Term.
It's going to, I mean, you know, the same thing happened with Bruce Hornsby. Like, Hornsby now, you know, he was like a soft rock guy in the 80s, and then he played with the Dead for a couple years, and now.
And then he was a soft rock guy in the 90s.
He was, but, like, you know, Deadheads follow him. I mean, you kind of have a built in constituency, and that's a smart thing to have as you're moving forward. I mean, what interests me about Dead & Co. is, like, I'm writing this book right now about sort of the end of the classic rock era, like how the people of that time, the 60s and 70s, how they're starting to die off, and that music is sort of fading into the background. And I'm fascinated by that because I grew up with that music. It's something I'm really interested in. And with Dead & Co., they fit in with the trend this year of classic rock bands starting to melt together, where you have... You know, you have Dead & Co., you have Axl Rose joining AC/DC. You have that bizarre Hollywood Vultures band where you have Alice Cooper and Joe Perry. And I saw them a couple weeks ago, and that was crazy. but, you know, it was interesting reading your story, because you have this line in there. You were talking about how Donna Jean, you know, the backup singer during the 70s, who wasn't part of the Fare Thee Well shows, but she's been kind of showing up now at these Dead & Co. Concerts, you know, lately. I think her first one was at Bonnaroo, right?
I can't say I've been keeping completely close to her, but
something like that. She's been showing up more.
She sang with Weir a couple of years ago, and she's sort of been poking up occasionally.
But you were saying,
which is great.
Well, yeah, you were saying in your story about how that kind of it helps. And I want to make sure I get your wording right. You said it's that much easier to hear the absent Garcia, you know, like, because it kind of it makes it feel more like the Dead. I mean, is that the goal in these situations, that, like, in a way, if you close your eyes, you can pretend that Jerry Garcia isn't dead?
No, not really. I mean, that's not what it is for me. I mean, I guess I want them to go play new, interesting, improvised music. And what happened for me at Fenway's, that did happen. There were stretches of improvised stuff that was, like, really cool and engaged and was unlike anything I've heard from any other Dead band before. So that was sort of, like, the piece that I want out of it. But at the same time, when, you know, they are up there singing Garcia's songs, you can't not hear Jerry in there. That's, you know, they wouldn't be singing the songs otherwise. I think. And for me, just having, you know, his two harmony partners right there, it's like suddenly it's a lot. His voice just sort of, like, it just pops in kind of your head very naturally, you know, when you hear Weir and Donna singing together. I think that it's kind of hard to avoid.
And then when you hear John Mayer singing, you're like, oh, Stevie Ray Vaughan is alive again.
Well, he's a little, I mean, you know, and that was another thing that made that show really so much more enjoyable for me, was the fact that I could that much more easily ignore him because Donna and Bobby were singing together. And
right.
then it's like, there's a third guy up there, but, that's not who I'm hearing.
Right. It does kind of give you like a new appreciation for Jerry Garcia's singing voice. He was always an underrated singer, I think. But
yeah. I mean, he's always been one of my favorites. So I've never needed any selling on that. But to tie this kind of to your next book project, which is a topic that I've been interested in for a long time, you know, growing up on, you know, people like The Dead, but also like Bob Dylan and Neil Young, and continuing to go see them now and seeing how they age and what happens to their voices and what happens to their stage presentation and sort of how they sort of like turn into these sort of, you know, older versions of themselves. But it is something that I do find, you know, that's part of the Dead experience as well, is that I do like parts of what Bob Weir has sort of evolved into as a musician. I mean, one of my real authentic, genuine highlights of that show is seeing him sing The Days Between, which is this, you know, like long droning dirge of a Garcia Hunter ballad that, you know, I feel like if he had tried to sing that in the 80s or the 90s, just would have not come across at all. And I think now that Weir is kind of aged into this sort of, you know, I mean, I guess John Mayer is kind of the new Weir in the band, and you know, Bobby's kind of this, you know, gray bearded, you know, eminence or whatever. But he really occupies that, or he really can. And it's funny that he's, you know, it's like, oh yeah, that's Bob Weir, that's the guy in the short shorts screaming at the end of Sugar Magnolia. But here he is singing The Days Between and really kind of killing it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, one of my complaints I didn't even really get to in that article is that I wish there were more Bob Weir songs. There's like, you know, that guy wrote a whole ton of great songs that I'd love, you know, I'd love to hear Black Throated Wind or something like that.
Yeah.
And anyway, but yeah.
Yeah. Anything but One More Saturday Night Again. They gotta retire that a couple of times, please. But, you know, I getting back to your point, I 100% agree. And you and I have similar interests in this regard, but like I like the fact that songs take on different meanings when they're sung by an artist who's like 30 years older. And when you see The Dead, when they play Not Fade Away Now, you know, there is a feeling like, well, maybe they won't make the next show, you know? So this kind of has like a added resonance to it, you know, that they're older now, and there is kind of a defiance in a way to play a song like that. It's like, no, we're going to keep going. And you definitely feel with that band that it's going to be the last man standing. I mean, you know, because the Fairly Well shows, you know, they were very hyped up as like, well, this is the end, which I don't know if anyone really believed that. I mean, of course not. If you sell out stadiums, you know, someone's going to say, hey, let's keep playing. You know, I mean, the demand is obviously there. And the Dead & Co. is playing 20,000 seat arenas on these stops.
Which I thought was really ambitious on their part, but has turned out to be, you know, they've turned, you know, I don't know, I don't think they've sold out every show, but, you know, Fenway was pretty freaking full. Like, that's, and I, you know, I think that really is kind of a little bit on the Dead brand, you know,
right.
But, you know, the thing that struck me and that I said in that review is that Dead & Co. really do feel like a band, like, way more than like, kind of the other iterations of the Dead that I've seen since Garcia died. With that included both Weir and Phil. And kind of what happens in those bands is that, you know, once Jerry died, the Dead never had a leader, but Jerry was obviously kind of the unspoken leader. But then without him, everybody's trying to be the leader. And I think this was the first Dead band I've ever seen, maybe Rat Dog, but like where the musicians on stage seemed to like actually pay attention to like Bob Weir's hand signals, where he would like, you know, throw his hand up in the air to signal that we're coming back into the song now from the jam. Whereas I think even in like, you know, the Fairly Well shows last summer, and I thought that was kind of creepy that they advertised them as the final shows. But even in those shows where there was a lot of cool jamming going on, like you would see him like raise his hand up in the air, and everybody would just like, you know, Phil and Trey would just continue to be noodling on, and Bobby would be trying to like pull the song back. But Dead & Co. really like kind of were in line and then marching together, and that's you know. That I wasn't really expecting, and that's cool to see like them playing like a band.
Yeah, it's a bold new era of following Bob Weir's lead. Jesse, it was great talking with you, man. This was really interesting, and again, everyone, read Heads. It's a great book. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
But yeah, thanks again, Jesse. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure, Steve. This is it was great.
All right.
Great talking.
All right, man. Take care. That was Jesse Giorno. And again, I highly recommend that you check out his book, Heads. Came out in March. It's been getting really great reviews, and I really liked the book a lot. I thought it was really interesting. So definitely pick that up. And now we're going to go to my interview with Todd Snyder. As I said before, you know, Todd, he's put out a bunch of albums on his own as a solo artist. Some of the best records that he's done include The Devil You Know, which came out in 2006. I'm a big fan of the record that came out before that, East Nashville Skyline. The record that he put out a couple years ago called Agnostic Tales and Stoner Fables. I think I got that title right. I might have butchered it. But anyway, that's a really great record as well. Now he's in this band called Hardworking Americans and includes members of Widespread Panic and the Chris Robertson Brotherhood, as well as some other jam bandy type projects. And their recent record, Rest in Chaos, I think is a really underrated record. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about it, at least in critical circles, but I like it a lot. Todd, he's really engaged with this band. It was really interesting to talk to him about it and how he sort of made the transition into this scene and like what attracted him to it. So we had a really good conversation about that, and here it is. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. There's no way in hell you remember this, but I've talked to you a couple times on the phone.
Let's see, Minneapolis gigs?
Well, I used to live in Milwaukee.
Sure.
Yeah, so like I've seen you at Shank Hall a bunch of times.
Sure, thank you, man. You weren't there when we did that Occupy thing, were you?
I don't think so. I think I had left by then. Like, I saw you play a couple solo shows there and then with Great American Taxi.
Sure, sure. God, I forgot I had that stint with those guys. I love those kids. Vinny Herman, man. Life-changing cat.
Well, and one of those Great American Taxi guys is in Hardworking Americans, right?
Yeah, he started the whole mess. He was to blame, actually. I was on my way to... him and I talk on the phone a lot. He's played on some of my records. Him and Vinny became mentory people in my life through the Taxi. They were all my friends, but those guys were the leaders. And they became people I talked to a lot. And Chad and I were talking on the phone about fear and things like that. And he had noticed that that I hung around John Prine and Jerry Jeff and older singers. And that he saw that there was a little bit of... He could tell there was some fear in it, that there was a reason why I wasn't hanging around people my own age. And when he called me on it, I owned it. And he was asking me who I knew that I would call or jam with if I wasn't intimidated. And the first person I said was David Schools. And he challenged me to do it, and I did it, and turned into a band.
What do you mean by fear?
I don't know as much about music as David, and so it's like you, sometimes if you say you're I don't know sports really, but say if you're a tennis player, I imagine that there could be moments where you're good, but you're not ready for a certain coach. Like say your 10-year-old kid might be a good pitcher, but he's not ready for the team of the Mets' guy to come coach him yet, you know, and so. I knew that I was below my skill set when I started jamming with him, and I knew that there would be a... I mean, I do that with the older people, too, but for some reason, that didn't matter to me. I'd be like, well, you're older than me. Why should I be as good as you?
Right.
But with the others, it was like, you know, it's a little harder to turn to a guy your age and go, yeah, I can't do that. So
right.
Well, maybe a different song or something. And then David's kind of goes, yeah, you can do it. We've got some time, and I'll show it to you. Now, I didn't end up playing guitar in the group because I don't think I'll ever be good enough to be in this band because this band's going to keep getting better. But, like, I'm getting better at the guitar from just not playing guitar with these guys. When I go back to my other gig, I can tell I've learned a ton, mostly from hearing them talk about it in the dressing room and stuff like that.
So with the music in Hardworking Americans, do you contribute at all to that, or are you just the words guy and the singer?
And sometimes the melody. Not always the words, too. I mean, some on the album, some lyrics got chimed in by some other guys, and then some got chimed out, which is also very helpful. When someone says, don't say that, it's as helpful as coming up with something. And then with the music, sometimes I would be the melody person, but sometimes Neil or Jesse would go out and just yell vowels, and then I would make up words for them later. But Yeah, with this, it's more about a trance or you just sort of go in and it's really fun to do. I don't know if it's always pleasing to the people watching or listening, but to the people doing it, I could see how you could get addicted to it. It's fun to try to write music like that just by dancing, just dancing it into being.
Right. I mean,
that's how it starts. All these songs started with David sending me out into the studio to dance to my own drummer. And he'd ball me up on LSD and say, go out there and dance. I'm like, to what? And he'd say, think of something.
And, I mean, do you feel like that helped? Like, you know, like taking acid and then going in the studio and dancing? I mean, do you feel like that helps? That helps
creatively? I feel like it's like you're dancing and you're yelling and you're trying to let go. Or I was. I shouldn't say anyone. I don't know if anyone else has done it or anything. But I was in that moment. I was just throwing my body around and letting sounds come out of my mouth and just trying to forget that I was being watched. And then, you know, you go back in there the next day and you listen to see if that person let go and said something vulnerable. And usually in that trance, you could be like, you know, this is just an example, but you're sort of tranced out and your friends are listening to you, going, kicking, and you're yelling and you're jumping and you're saying, cars kick ass and the sun's so pretty today, my mother never loved me and I don't know why, but I still, and they go, what, wait, back up, what? Why did that come out, you know? And it seemed like every time that I would yell some sort of pivotal thing that would make them stop and ask me to come back in, it always felt a little embarrassing. But they'd be like, why'd you say that? You know, well, I don't remember even saying that. Play it back and let's hear me say it. And then that would be sort of an emotional, sort of almost like a therapy kind of a thing where I'd be like, well, geez, I didn't mean to say that. But now that that's out there, yeah, that this happened to me once and that must be bubbling in my life. And then they're like, let's keep on that. And then I would start churning away at it as a poem. And then I have all these other poems laying around that aren't finished. And so if a poem starts to show up having a life or having a heart, when you can tell that what it is, then I can go back through all my other poems and find little bits that will fit with it.
So you've sort of answered one of my questions, because I was wondering if your writing for the band was different for the writing that you do for yourself. Like if you have certain lyrics or that seem more suited for the band than for yourself, but it sounds like in a way the lyrics are coming out of sort of the experience of playing together.
Right. And right before one of the things I feel like I feel like I shortchanged them a little in that they were coming to me as a lyricist, right? As my last album, Agnostic Hymns, I wouldn't say I changed the way that I made up lyrics, but not deliberately. It just happened that they started coming to me more like in one phrase at a time, and I wasn't concentrating on waking up a song in general and as much as just collecting one thought here and another thought there, and this idea that the whole song could be like the title, that every line could be the reason for itself. And that, to me, I was just fell into that because I was getting older. And if you're singing 30 nights in a row, all that parts of the song that's sort of filler or just getting you to the other part can get draining. And so my solution was to try to just have the reason for the song be every single line. And it worked in, as far as like being able to play those songs over and over and over and over and over again. But I don't know that it worked in the sense of people liking them more.
Well, I have to say, I'm the new record, Rest in Chaos, I like it a lot. I've been listening to it a lot. And it's a record that I'm drawn to it because there's a really kind of unique emotional vibe to it. On one hand, I feel like a lot of the songs musically have this sort of great old-time rock and roll, good time vibe to it.
Right.
But there's also rolling underneath it some dark vibes going on.
Yeah.
And it's almost, they exist concurrently throughout the record. And it's interesting because...
Thank you, man. That makes me feel good.
I mean, so that was something that you feel like you were trying to capture on the record.
Yeah, letting my people that I like the most, like the Prines and the stuff, I feel like if I'm honest, or Dylan, you know, I don't think I'll get that good, but why not try, you know? And I feel like when those cats play. You can't tell. You can't say what kind of song it is. You can't say what it's about. You can't say this is a happy song or this is a sad song or this is an exciting one or this one. It's all of it. It's like scary, funny, happy, heartbreaking. A lot of Randy Newman, people like that, it feels like. And I was trying to find some part of myself that maybe could get out there where Robert Hunter lives. I don't think I'm succeeding at it in the sense of the way it's being received, but I think in the way that I'm doing it, I'm finding some common ground in some artists that I liked more when I was younger that they say they were sort of searching for that song too, that would have less, that would be maybe harder to follow the first time you heard it, but you could follow it a lot further.
Right. And, you know, I feel like, and this is true of a lot of the guys that you just mentioned, but like for you, you know, I've been listening to your records for a long time, and you know, I don't know you at all, but I feel like I know you or a version of you from your records, and you're a guy that I worry about, you know, or I'm happy for. Like I feel like I have a personal connection to you, and I, you know. Like I had read that you had recently gotten divorced. So like when I heard the song, It Runs Together, it's like I'm investigating that song to see, oh, is Todd okay? Can I discern it from these lyrics?
Yeah.
And I want to ask you about that song because I love that song. But I'm wondering first, is that a common thing for you? Do you find like when you meet fans that they feel like they already know you? And if so, is that strange for you?
I do. I have been to a therapist about the deal that like people will wait in the lobby to bring me a coat, or like there's this general sense of worry that people worry about me, you know, or like in I'm not kidding. Like if we stay in a nice hotel, they almost always, if I'm in the lobby, they'll come up. Somebody from the hotel will come up like a homeless man has wandered in, and they're not going to be mean about it, but and they always like, hello, can I help you? No. Are you a guest with us? Uh-huh. You know, I'm like, oh, I get it. And I don't know why I put off this hair of, I don't know where that comes from, but I went to a shrink about it like 8 years ago, and because I said, like, I was at this festival, and I was standing next to this other guy who just played, and he was signing his CD, and I was signing mine, and everybody was just telling him he was great, and everybody was giving me shoes and asking me where I was going, and if... And if I needed anything, and I thought maybe I should stand straighter, but maybe it's just a, you know, I think different people can have different types of electrical shit coming off of them, even if they don't want to, you know. Sometimes I'll meet the person, I'll be like, that guy's not going to be nice to me, I can just feel it, you know. So maybe I have that just, I don't really have a plan, you know, so if people can smell that, then maybe they can smell that coming off of me.
Well, I think there is a vulnerability to your songs, but also just the way that you write and the way that you sing, there is also a kind of conversational thing. So, like, if you're listening to your records in the car, it feels like you're just a guy sitting in the passenger seat next to you talking, you know? So there is maybe that as well, where it's like, I know that guy. Maybe I went to college with that guy 20 years ago, and now I'm seeing him in the lobby, and I'm worried about him or something. You know, I think there's that, too. There's an intimacy, I think, to... your music, and that's a compliment, I think.
I hope so. I mean, that makes me feel good. And I do feel like when people do just come up to me and stuff, I tend to get along with them. You know, I mean, like, it doesn't bug me. And it's nice to worry about. I mean, I'm like, oh, that's really sweet, you know, that you would worry about me. You know? But, and then also, it's nice that somebody would feel like they could come up and say hello to you if you don't, they don't even know you.
Right.
I like meeting people.
So that song, It Runs Together, you know, it talks about, you know, and I recognized it from stories you've told on stage and even in other songs, that, you know, meeting your wife, like your ex-wife in rehab. And then you also talk about how you went to when you were in rehab at that time in Arizona, that Phil Hartman's wife was there at the same time.
Yeah, Bryn was her name. And she was in my group, you know, she was my friend. And then she killed him and herself. And I'm not sure how that ended up in the song. Although, I mean, the song's just true. You know, I met this woman. We met at rehab. We got out of rehab. We got really drunk. We were on, I don't remember where we were flying or why we got thrown off, but they taxied all the way back, you know, so everybody was so angry.
Yeah.
And then we had to rent a car. I don't remember if I made the show or what. But I remember that we got to the hotel and she jumped in the shower and I turned on the TV, and as soon as I turned it on, there was that picture of my friend from rehab, and I thought, damn, this can't be good. And then I didn't know Phil Hartman was her husband, but I knew her husband was a famous kid. She said that her husband was famous and that his initials were PH. And that's all I knew. But then when that came on the news, it all just went, you know, I grokked it all. She was a nice woman, you know, other than, you know, being, other than being, the, now those few minutes where she was clearly not.
Yeah. I mean, when stuff like that happens, does the songwriter in you recognize it right away and say, you know, I could maybe use this in a song at some point? I mean,
yeah, sometimes it's more dread, you know, because like she was nice and here I'm gonna use her and exploit her. Or if some, you know, like my buddy from the Train song, I know that Skip would have loved to have been in a song. And then it's hard though. I mean, I get a lot out of that man's death. He was my best friend though. And I think he'd like it, but there's a perverseness to it that if you come into my life, you might get used like that. There's a Randy Newman song that says, I would sell my soul. Hell, I would sell your soul for a song.
So, I mean, do you feel like on some level it's exploitation if you do that?
A little bit. You know, I'm not, I mean, if the person came up and complained, I'd tell them to shake it off maybe, but maybe not. You know, I have thought, will those children approach me someday? And if they do, I will feel indebted to them in whatever way they say. You know, if they come up to me and say, here's how I feel because my mom and dad were in a song, I will say, okay, so what do you want me to do? I will do it.
So,
and that, I feel that would be, you know, I think that would be the nice thing to do. Not that I have to do the nice thing, but I feel like if they come to me someday, I'll want to help them if I can.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a song like that, in a way, it's a benefit to her because it humanizes her. It puts, you know, because she's only going to be remembered for this one thing.
Yeah.
So to put her in a different context, you know, it is more of a humanizing thing.
Yeah. I felt so sad for her. I could feel that she, you know, when people have goals, boy, and then they don't get them. That's why I don't want any, man.
And that's something you've said before, and in songs and in interviews. I mean, do you really feel like you don't have any goals?
Just other than to be present.
Yeah.
You know? I'm pretty good at it. That was kind of something I was good at when I was young, and just not getting caught up in rethinking what happened or planning for what's going to happen.
Right. Getting back to sort of that humanizing people thing, you know, it also makes me think of that song Acid on the new record, which is probably my favorite song on the record.
Oh, thank you.
Love that song. And it's a song about Charles Manson.
Yeah.
And I don't think you actually ever say it's Charles Manson in the song, but you mentioned Kathleen Maddox.
Right.
And there's a great line in the song, too, where, you know, you reference the Beatles, because obviously the Beatles, the White Album, that's part of Charles Manson's lore, but you say it's not just the Beatles. You know, we also listen to the Moody Blues, which is, you've obviously done your Charles Manson homework.
Yeah, he was really into them.
Yeah, like what was it, you know, I mean, again, I feel like this is another instance of you taking this person who's sort of known for one thing and looking at it from a slightly different perspective, where it's more, he's just sort of this guy that wanted to be a musician, had dreams, and then obviously it took a bad left turn.
Right.
Like, what was it about Manson that, you know, kind of attracted you and made you want to write about him?
Well, I had started, I've always liked him, and I've always felt sorry for him in a certain sense, in that you can't have a Dylan without having a Charles Manson. If you're going to be a culture that crowns somebody Dylan, you're going to be a culture that tells somebody else that it really means a lot to be Dylan, that they're not. And you have to deal with that guy, too. You want to have a prom king? Well, you also got the kid that really wanted to be the prom king that ain't.
Right.
And that's what you get when you hand out trophies. And so I didn't see him. I mean, I think his temper tantrum for not getting what he wanted in life was way over the top and affected a lot of people in a horrific way. And I don't know how people are supposed to pay for those types of mistakes. I don't know if being in the box is helping, but I also feel like it was just an interesting story to me that this person had this whole life that it's almost understandable if you research it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, what do you think about him as a songwriter? I mean, you're a songwriter.
Yeah.
Do you like his songs? Do you think he had talent?
I thought they were okay, you know, and I wouldn't have, like a lot of people, like, I wonder if he'd have been nurtured or if somebody would have told him to keep doing it. He probably was for sure going to be some kind of an artist, you know, but then he'd grown up, he wanted to just be a pimp, and how do you be a pimp in the 60s when it's free love, you know? And
right.
That was what he had been trained in, and that was the field he knew. And I mean, it's interesting character. And then, you know, now there's just so many people, notorious murderers.
Right, right. Well, and he's so different too. Just, I mean, the one thing that you meet that makes you think that he could have been a rock star was just the charisma that he had to convince people to do these terrible things.
Yeah,
I mean, it is a dark thought, but like there is an element to that of rock stardom where rock stars can make huge crowds sort of bend to their will. You know,
yeah.
He was able to do that in a little way.
Yeah, I felt that too. That whole generation, that whole young group of kids after World War II. I was going to say that. Also, as we were working on the album, I had been working on these poems, and there was 12 poems and 12 sets of lyrics, we might re-release. It was initially supposed to be a concept record called Take the Blind Lemon Pledge and Stick It to the Man. It was this story that I identified with, and I thought that it paralleled my own life, and I came up with this game and this legend of a person called the Blind Lemon Pledge who had been Elvis Presley's friend, and who understood what rebellion was, and he noticed when Elvis stopped doing it, and it tells this story about how rebellion in America got curbed in after the 60s, and Manson was part of that, and I came up with this long story about how after World War II, there was this enormous threat of peace brought about by rock and roll, that the man who makes bullets, and you know, if the person who's in charge of the world is the one that's arming it, and that person doesn't want the war to end any more than cigarette people want you to quit smoking. And so we figured this person saw Elvis coming and saw him as the end of his own business. And so he set out to destroy Elvis by creating the Black Panthers and Charles Manson. And then when he got rid of that, when he got rid of that thing, and my preposition in the story is that Elvis was going to show white kids that black kids weren't anything to be afraid of, especially young black males, and that the man did not want white people to not be afraid of young black males. And so he shut out the Black Panthers, he shut down the hippies, he brought in the Fonz, he brought in Reagan. I mean, it's all kind of funny. It doesn't sound funny as I'm saying it now, but it's this kind of absurd poem. And then it ends with saying that Elvis was going to reinstate the natural laws of absurdity. And then the game is that it's now on you to go out and reinstate the natural laws of absurdity by doing something foolish. And then there's this game where you go out with your friends and you go to a bar that you can't really afford to be at. And there's different challenges. You have to find the Manson and you have to find the Fonz and you have to deal with them. And then once you have, you find the king and you take him back to Memphis. So you go to a bar that you don't usually go to, find somebody you don't know, convince that person to go someplace else with you, and together you embarrass yourselves. And if you do that, you've won the game that the hardworking Americans invented.
What's that game called?
Take the Blind Lemon Pledge and Stick It to the Man. And I think it's coming out for Christmas, because there was this whole concept album that kind of fell apart when I had these big businessmen, David Pritzker, he runs like the Hilton, George Bodecker, Bert Stein, and I got them to play the game. And they came back the next day and said, you can't play it. And George got arrested trying to. And that they didn't think, that they thought I should take it back into the shop, because it's just going to get people in trouble and that you can't win. And then, so, but I thought, yeah, that's the game. But you did win. But so now there's this book that we're working. So this guy's writing a book about our last album and the failed attempt at making it a board game and the concept. And then the book comes out, and then maybe the actual game comes out. I built it. I'm staring right at it. But when I show it to my rational friends, they laugh at me.
All right, well, I'm hoping this will be up by Christmas.
I want it to be, too. It has a spinner. You know, you spin. There's men. There's a board. But then as soon as you spin, you have to leave your house. So yeah.
That's always a trick to get people to leave their house. So if you can do that, that would be great. So I want to talk to you about this transition you made from being sort of a guy that stands alone on stage with a guitar to being the front man of this band. You know, I always feel like you've had an interesting career because you get sort of described as a folk singer, although you've done rock and roll records, you've done kind of country-ish records. You're sort of a guy who doesn't really fit comfortably under any one kind of banner. But now you're in this band that gets described as a jam band, and you're sort of part of that scene.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, like, what are your thoughts on the jam band scene as a guy? I mean, I know that you were probably a fan of jam bands. Maybe you were an audience member for a while, but like, what is your feeling as a sort of a participant now in that scene? Because I feel like that scene, it's something that you either know everything about or you know nothing about, you know,
right.
It kind of exists outside of mainstream music culture. So like, what are your feelings about, you know, that culture?
I'm glad you asked me that. I genuinely consider it our country's best side.
Yeah.
And I think it's the if you make music for those people, that it's the funnest people to make music for, because because I feel like they're coming at music the way I'm coming at it, almost as a religious thing, not as a frivolous thing. It's like a genuine way to give thanks to whatever put us here. And I think in that crowd, because nobody's afraid to be corny or weird or high or anything, they just like, this is how I give thanks to God. I dance to Widespread. And then you try to do that at Wilco or something, and people are like, dude, stop being that guy. I'm like, all right, but maybe I want to be that guy, you know? And so, you know, it's like this sensitive crowd. I took my nephew not long ago to I forget what band it was, but he's like, what a thing. Or the other day I was at a Chris Robinson Brotherhood show, and I was in the front row with these big old gals, and there was about 5 minutes left till they came on, and one of them was like, you ready? And I was like, I am ready. And everybody was like, okay, you guys ready? And I was like, we're not here to judge them or stare at them and see if we think they're good tonight. It's a thing. We're involved too. You know, we have to help. And it's tribal to me. And like, when I'm around people like David or Chris Robinson, or I even got to jam with Bob Weir once, it feels like these lightning rods or these type conduit type people that I've always admired from the crowd. I like to spin like a dervish under whatever elements there are, you know, and think it's profound. And David thinks it's profound. He doesn't think it's just jamming. He sees Spreadheads moving, and he feels like he's genuinely doing something that's good for them. And I agree, you can't prove it, but I think it's good for your health to move to music in a joyous way.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. The way you just described it, I think, is dead on with the religious aspect, because I recently started going to Phish shows, like a couple of years ago. I had a friend that was going, and Phish before that, I was a band that, like, I just sort of, like, disliked in a knee-jerk way, you know, because I was sort of conditioned to say that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I realized at one point, I'm like, I don't even know any of these band's songs. Like, how can I dislike this band? And then I started going to shows, and I really enjoyed it. But, like, when I would tell friends of mine that I was going to these shows, it was like I said I was a born-again Christian or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? Or, like, I collect Precious Moment figurines or something. Like, it was like a weird thing. But, yeah, it is this celebration that goes on, and like, people sort of dismiss it out of hand without even really knowing what it is.
Right. And essentially it's just dancing, which is, there's like this guy, I mean, there's a lot of people that that would describe, like scientists would describe that as just being really all that's happening. And anyway, and so when you stop and flow with it, if you think about it that way, and you've got to really smoke a lot of dope and take a lot of drugs to get that pretentious and silly, but why not? You know, if you get there one day and you're like, and you feel it and you want to move to it, and I think that's a lot like those Christians when they're like, it hit me one day, so screw you. I don't care if you approve. And I think there's a lot of that going on in fish parking lots and stuff like that.
Right.
I like the idea that it goes on in AC/DC and Metallica parking lots too, maybe more violently. But I think the thing I like about the jam band scene, though, is that energy, it's a collective energy that seems to be, the goal seems to be happiness.
Right. Well, and connecting it to like AC/DC or Metallica or like metal, you know, that when you're in those crowds, you know that people are there because they want to be there. Because it's not the cool thing to be there. You maybe even get made fun of by other people if you wear, you know, tie-dye shirts, or you're wearing like the metal shirts, or you have long hair. But it's like, I don't care. This is something that means something to me, and it's not like a trendy thing, or I'm not doing it to be seen or something.
Right, I agree. I think in those parking lots, there's still this element of, I love AC/DC, maybe more than I like jam music, but it's for the young. It's like, in those parking lots, there's still some revenge fantasies going on. Like, we would like to beat the shit out of that stepdad, maybe, still. Whereas if you go see Widespread, we're done. We forgive the stepdad. We hope he's fine, man. He was an ass, but I hope he figured it out. You know, instead of, what if we set fire to his tools? Or, you know, like, there's a letting go of animosity that goes along with the hippie scene. That was a turnoff to me about punk. I like punk, the sound of it. I just don't like bands that are formed based on the bands they don't like.
Right. You know, as far as being a frontman of a band, was that something that came naturally to you? Or did you have to, like, study other frontmen to sort of know how to move without a guitar?
Well, I just tried it, you know, and still, I dread to go watch it or anything. I haven't seen it. I think the thing that I let go and then try, like, I let go completely and then just deal with what people say about it. It's like not an effort to be good. It's just an effort to be, you know, like, I'm not trying to do it well, I guess. I'm just trying to do it. And in that sense, I don't feel like there's really a way to do it differently. You just on or off. I just go up there and stand there and I don't really do anything. I just kind of sing and listen.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like I've ever been in that side of music. Like, I know there's choreographed styles of music, you know. But the only real choreography that goes on in my type of music is that, like, we are very deliberately going to live lives of total chaos. That part's choreographed, and then that will bleed into what's happening. There's just this element of I guess the only part that is planned is to just let go and stay let go till the whole tour's over.
Yeah. Well, you said before that when you were in the studio that you took acid to sort of loosen up and get into a creative space. Are you able to do that and perform on stage?
Sure. I think that drugs help you to not care. This is why they tell you not to take drugs, because they lower your inhibitions. But that's what I'm trying to do as an artist. When you say the word artist, it sounds pretentious, but as a singer, I'm trying to not give a rat's ass what anybody thinks about me, and I'm trying not to give a rat's ass about anything else. And so, I think it helps a lot if you take acid and you're lost in some other adventure. It's easy to forget that it's a production and that it starts at 9 and all that shit.
I mean, but can you still, like, remember the words?
I think so. I haven't. There was one show in L.A. where I think I took way too, like, I got lost trying to find the show, and then I gave up, and some kids found me in some other club, and they were like, we're about to go to your gig. And I was like, I knew that. I knew that I was supposed to be someplace besides here, you know. And I said, take me to these kids took me over there, And then when I got there, I could tell the band was like, uh-oh. And then I remember that night, they said I didn't sing into the microphone very much. And sometimes I would just add words that weren't there. But usually I just, I don't go too far. And then I threw, that night in L.A., I remember the band said, okay, not that.
But, you know, again, the great thing about being in a jam band is that you can say, well, that was the moment, and I was creating a singular moment with that.
Right. Or so, yeah, they say, oh, you open the door and show people what's in there, and it's not always going to be exactly what they were hoping for. And, you know, I remember, that's funny you say that, because Neil, I think a guitar player, in the same breath that they were saying, not that, they got that they were saying, you know, that you did what you're supposed to do, we're just hoping that that's not what's in your heart that much. You know, because you threw things at everyone. I unloaded fruit on the... I know I threw fruit at the crowd. That's embarrassing to say. But in my mind, it made sense at the time.
Yeah. And they won't forget that show, probably. So,
right. But,
by the way, Neil Casale, one of my favorite guitar players right
and
now.
And just a sweet person, too. But, God, I think he's the top guitar player in America right now. In the world, probably.
So, like, I've been a fan of his since when he was in the Cardinals.
Oh, I love that stuff.
Yeah.
So and then he's around two of my favorites. I love Ryan Adams songs. And I love Chris Robinson songs.
Yeah, I've seen the Chris Robinson Brotherhood. Yeah, he's great in that band, too.
He's one of my favorite, of my age. He's my favorite poet my age.
Yeah. Well, Todd, thank you so much, man, for giving me some time this morning.
I appreciate it.
It's always great talking with you.
Thank you. I'll see you soon, I hope. Have fun.
Yeah, you too, man. Take care. All right, that was Todd Snyder wrapping up our special jam band episode of Celebration Rock. And hopefully if you're into jam band music, this was interesting for you. And if you're not into jam band music, at least maybe you have a different perspective now. And by the way, if you listen to the end of this episode and you're not into jam bands, I am very grateful to you. And I kind of can't believe that you did it, but I'm very glad that you did. So thank you for doing that. I also want to give a shout out to our sponsor for this episode, Blue Apron. Again, head over to blueapron.com/celebration and you will get 3 free meals plus free shipping when you sign up. So that's a great deal. Thanks again, guys, for listening to this episode of Celebration Rock. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you guys, and we'll see you again next week.